If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process. From syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Stop blaming it on holiday stress. We all know it's that time of year when everything feels drained, both your wallet and you. Well, the real problem is right under you. It's that saggy, old, unsupportive mattress. Well, say hello to Ghostbed. Ghostbed is family-run, consumer-loving, with over 20 years of mattress-making mastery. They've engineered the perfect sleep weapon. Durable, insanely comfortable, and cool enough to keep you chill all night long. Every Ghostbed packs their exclusive ProCore technology, a powerhouse support system that cradles your back, supports, and aligns your spine. Translation? You wake up feeling like a human again. Hot sleeper? Ghostbed's cooling materials fight heat 24/7, so you don't wake up sweaty, even when the thermostat that's cranked up. And here's the kicker. Fast, free shipping in just 2 to 5 days. A 101-night sleep trial. And up to a 25-year warranty. That's confidence. Right now, Ghostbed is slashing prices. Up to 50% off compared to other brands. And because you're listening, you score an extra 10% off site-wide. Just use promo code PODCAST at checkout. That's PODCAST for 10% off on top of already insane deals. Upgrade your sleep. Upgrade your life. Ghostbed. The coolest beds in the world.
Hello, everyone. What is up? I am Rob, and with me is...
It's Eamon.
And we have a very, very, very special guest today. Joining us is Paul from the Mysteries and Monsters podcast. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm very well. Thank you for your invitation, gentlemen.
Sure looks not a bother at all, Paul.
The pleasure.
So Paul has a great podcast that you guys should go and check out. And I think, Paul, you're more interview-based than we are, yeah?
Well, that's apparently the premise of the show. But yeah, usually it's me just waffling on about monsters. Yeah, well,
that's what I think to waffle on about, isn't it? So you've had a lot of cool guests on. And what we kind of miss, I think, with our podcast is that we don't get the first-hand accounts. And I've noticed that about yours, that you get a lot of the first-hand accounts. Like, people will talk about, you know, things that they've seen, or they'll have a ghost story or anything like that. Do you have anything, I suppose, cryptid or ghost based that really springs out to your mind as something that really sort of spooked you, made you fill your pants full of wagon wheels or something, you know?
I grew up in a haunted house. So when my parents got together, we rented the middle house in a converted vicarage, because I grew up in a town just a little village just outside of a town called Barnsley in South Yorkshire. And we were the middle house across the road from the church as well. So the church was just across the road with the graveyard and everything. And we were in the old vicarage that had been converted into 3 separate houses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So that was like proper spooky looking, and like the quintessential kind of haunted environment.
Oh, very much so, because it was quite dilapidated as well, because it's like the early to mid 70s, the days where it was single glazing, coal fires. Obviously, living in Barnsley, we were all right for coal, and it was all right for the first sort of couple of years, and then stuff just started happening. I always tell people this because it's quite funny that we always knew when things were about to start because the toilet used to flush.
Oh, that is right. On its own.
Yeah, and it was a pull chain. So obviously, it's not like these days.
Yeah, the pull chains are even more spooky there. But my granny used to have a pull chain toilet, and I was like, what the fuck is this shit? So that just used to flush. And then was there anything else spooky about the place? Like, did you get any kind of weird... Because I suppose people associate, like, you know, cold chills. And myself and Eamon have seen shadow people before. So is there anything like that that you've seen while you were in that gaff in particular?
No, well, we, I mean, I don't remember it, but my mother used to say that she would hear me speaking with someone every night. Apparently, oh, wow. He would sit on my bed, and he was apparently a really nice old gentleman. And we used to have very pleasant conversations, apparently. Now, I don't remember much about it. I've kind of got a really hazy memory of it. But other than that, we didn't see things. It was just stuff would happen, like the bath would fill up on its own.
That's spooky.
That's right. So you had like the ghost of a sort of a plumber or something.
Yeah.
It was kind of like fixing the toilet, putting the ball cock into the cistern and shit.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just a very creepy old house. Carpets used to roll up. There was a lot of sort of DIY going on, I think.
Oh, yeah, the ghost of DIY, man. That's pretty handy Andy. The ghost of Handy Andy was going around your gaff. That's cool though, man. We lived in, when I was a child, we lived in a really old house as well. And it was part of the town here in Wexford, the main street.
Yeah.
And that would have been built probably late 1800s, something like that. So it was quite old, maybe even older, actually. And my younger brother, so it's funny that you say that, but my younger brother used to do things like talk and hallucinate and stuff. And I can only imagine, and he was only like probably a toddler.
Yeah.
And he used to like hallucinate, and like my mom would check on him, you know, he'd be disturbed or whatever. And he'd be saying like, oh, there's spiders all over the roof, there's spiders everywhere. Oh. And there was nothing there. Like, so with kids as well, I think they make everything more fucking spooky. So you're like, what? You know, if a kid starts saying it, you're like, oh shit. Like, this makes
funny. Yeah. Place. My niece is always going on about the monster that lives in the fireplace. And it, you know, initially I was like, you know, she hears the wind or whatever. And now I'm kind of like, Alana, you need to start shutting the fuck up. You're freaking your uncle out here. Like, I'm not into this anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'm the worst kind of friend to have, because if my mate's kids start talking about stuff like this, I just go, oh, really? Tell me all about it. What do they do?
Yeah. He'll be on the podcast next.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised you guys have got some ghosts over there, because Loftus Hall, as far as I'm aware, is one of the most haunted houses in Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not far from us at all, Paul. Yeah. It's like, it's around the corner, really. Like, growing up, it was always a place that we heard quite a bit about. And it was, it was kind of like, I think there's a lot of folklore in English culture, and much the same, I suppose, in UK culture in general.
Yeah.
And much the same here in Ireland. A lot of folklore. So, you know, as a kid, we grew up hearing about the Banshee or the Bogeyman or Boogeyman. And Loftus Hall was another one. And yeah, I went down there before it opened back up for tours. Mm. It's actually for sale again now.
Yeah,
I think it actually just sold.
Oh, did it? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know who bought it or anything, but I think it actually just sold. Yeah, they even did a horror movie. The Deep, The Depth, the I don't know,
right,
something like that. But it's set in Loftus Hall, and there's a little trapdoor, and you go into this upside down water place or whatever, and there's the devil and the spirits, you know yourself. But a very, very spooky place, and even the environment and the weather around it, like, you can imagine.
Yeah.
How creepy it would have been to live there in those kind of much more superstitious times, you know?
We had a few scares with that place. Actually talked about it on a very early episode of the podcast. When I was probably about 18, so it's probably like close to 15 years ago. Mm. We said, oh, we'll go out to Loftus. This is when it was closed down to the public completely. Like,
yeah.
I said, well, let's go and have a look. You know yourself, when you're young and you hear about a haunted house or a castle or something, you're like, let's go and check this place out, you know?
Yeah.
And we get out there. I have my cousin with me, and he's absolutely langered drunk. He's out there drinking a fucking beer. And we get there, and there, I don't know if it's still there. I think it is. There's kind of a little extension that you don't really see on the main building, and that's like part of the kitchens or something like that. And so we got up on that roof there, and he got into the loft space. There's like a loft space above that, and it's all wooden rafters and stuff. It's like really tight confined space as well. It's not even a big space.
Yeah.
And there was like dead birds in there and everything. And like I eventually got him out because I was like, this is exactly how a horror movie starts. The dumbass, yeah. the drunk dumbass gets into the loft, he falls through the ceiling, and the sensible guy has to jump down after him, and then he gets fucking eaten by the devil or some shit, you know. so we bailed out of it. But we went out another time actually. And we didn't know that it was just when it got bought by the previous owners.
Mm.
And we went out one night. This was like 2 a.m. It's kind of like a Wexford thing to go out to fucking Loftus Hall and strip it down.
Mm.
We were like, right, let's go and check it out. So
yeah.
We went out. It was nighttime. We were all spooked out. There's about 4 of us. And we walked up to the house and we turned the corner. And more scary than a ghost or anything, we turned the corner and there's a guy actually sitting in a porta cabin watching TV. And that actually made us right. Like, that made us shit our pants more than anything else. You know, we just ran off. We're like, oh, get the hell out of there. But it was, it's Loftus Hall. It's a spooky place. Have you heard anything about Loftus? Have you had any third party stuff about it? What's been your exposure to Loftus, I suppose?
Well, I've always had a real affinity with old-fashioned ghost stories like that, and because when I was a kid I was obsessed with Peter Underwood's ghost books, and he used to do loads about old houses around the UK and Ireland, so I've always had a real thing for creepy old places in Ireland and England and around the islands, so it's always quite good. But I always liked the story of Loftus Hall because it's one of those that's got the origin story of the devil turning up, I think.
Yeah.
Something to do with playing cards and this stranger takes a fancy to the... Because obviously, ironically, I'm a Tottenham fan for my sins.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously, I believe that the family who owned this hall at the time were the Tottenham family.
Very true.
Mm-hmm. And this stranger turned up and took a fancy to their daughter Anne, and I think she drops something on the floor and realizes he's got hooves.
Yeah, for pretty much goes to pick up a card, sees his hooves, and she's like, ah, avast. And then he just basically launches himself through the ceiling, you know, flies away. And obviously that old trope, they can never patch up the ceiling. But it is funny because you see a lot of that. Like, we just did an episode on the Jersey Devil a couple of months ago, and a similar kind of a thing, because, you know, obviously it's this cursed child that the in one series of the stories anyway, that the mother sort of says, 13 child, I've had enough, I'm cursing him, whatever. But again, comes out winged, flies through the ceiling, hole in the ceiling. And I think there's a lot of like sort of folkloric bits and pieces like that, you know, of just someone basically blasting away, causing irreparable damage to somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the subjects I wanted to sort of dive into, because I know we were on about looking a bit, England's a bit rubbish for cryptids, so
Ireland's not much better, to be
honest. Well, at least you've got more lake monsters and sea serpents than we have in England.
Maybe. Well, yeah, in England itself, I suppose. But if you want to claim the whole of UK, I mean, you've got Loch Ness Monster. He's like A-tier cryptid right there, you know?
Yeah. We just did our tier cryptids for a patron special. I believe Loch Ness. Was he S or A? He was A up there. Yeah, that's like the best you can get.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it is a fabulous place. And it's somewhere, one of my first ever monster trips out, I went to Loch Ness for 3 or 4 days. And it's just, well, even if you don't see anything, it's just a stunning part of the British Isles. It's incredible.
Yeah, no doubt, man. I'd say so. We have Dor Cu, which is kind of like a giant sort of an otter. Dor Cu was actually one of the most interesting, because there's actually, and I think we were on a podcast episode about monster talk, and we talked a little bit about this, but one of the most interesting things about the Dor Cu is that there's actually physical evidence of something, or at least of the story happening, I suppose you could say. So
yeah,
they have the graves, the tombstones that have engravings on them that depict what happened.
Yeah. And
it's kind of rare that you would find that, I suppose, in any sort of cryptozoological type of thing.
True. Yeah, and really good, like you're saying, Rob, really good folklore roots as well, because it's all about the guy who was saying it had killed his wife and he had the tombstone, and you're saying, you know, that had that story there. I'm always curious about what the, even if it wasn't some sort of cryptid or ghost or ghoulish kind of a character, but what I have this strong sense that people will generally, in most cases of ghosts and cryptids and all sorts of sightings, they're not lying about it. Like, that's their experience, whether or not it happened exactly that way or whether you could debunk it. But I think the majority of people are probably telling the truth in this stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose, definitely. There's been a few guys, Paul, even on your podcast, that when I heard them talking about stuff, I was like, you know, Jesus. Like, I suppose, admittedly, for me, it sounds hard to believe initially when you first listen to it. But then they say it with such conviction that you're like, okay, well, I mean, who am I to argue with it? I mean, these people seem like they're genuine. They're just talking. They're telling their story. And they seem mad genuine about it. So you're kind of like, well, I have to take it at face value. Is there any sort of stories that stick out in your head that someone's told you on the podcast where you're like, okay, yeah, this one's pretty crazy, like in a good way, like this sounds kind of real or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Tony Healy's probably one of my favorite guests I've ever had on. He's an Australian paranormal researcher and cryptozoologist, so he does a lot of hunting for yowies.
And
poltergeists. Nice. And he, alongside his co-investigator Paul Cropper, investigated probably Australia's most famous poltergeist case, which is called Humpty Doo,
right? Nice.
Which is the local term for things not being quite right, which is quite ironic. It's a place known as the Upside Down, which is why they call it Humpty Doo.
Right.
And it's a very infamous case. It's one of those where the media investigated it and blamed it all on this woman, even though it's one of those where there's hundreds of things going on. And then somebody goes, oh, well, it's her, even though half the time stuff was happening when she wasn't there and things like that. And they were saying that they were investigating it and stones were falling from the ceiling, and things were just banging on the walls and stuff. And when you speak to somebody that's got first-hand experience of poltergeist cases, especially in this day and age, because a lot of them are all kind of from the 50s and 60s and 70s, whereas Humpty Doo was kind of happening in the sort of late 90s.
Okay, recently enough then.
Yeah, right. So it was quite interesting to listen to somebody who had first-hand experience of going to something that was still active at that point, because they actually went there on a detour because they were going to go and investigate a Yowie sighting, which was quite near, because the Northern Territories is one of those places in Australia where not a lot of Yowie reports come from that area. So it was quite interesting for them. Because a lot of them obviously happen towards the southeast, Queensland and New South Wales. So they thought, well, it's a Northern Territories Yowie sighting, so that's quite interesting. And they decided to detour to pop in and see this allegedly haunted house. And it's such an interesting case. It's fantastic.
I have a quick question, actually, Paul, on that one, because obviously you've talked to a lot of people, you know, whether it's kind of cryptids or kind of ghostly stuff.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Are you familiar with the podcast Strange Familiars, that Timothy Renner? Yeah. So here's the question. He talks a lot about the other, and he talks about, like you're saying there, someone, they're going off, you know, trying to track down a Yowie or something similar. And sort of there's this strange synchronicity then where they wind up coming across like a poltergeist type thing. And in some cases, maybe a UFO type thing or some sort of other high strangeness. it's really interesting that you said that, because it was something I was thinking of. I was reading a book recently about the jinn, the Middle Eastern kind of spirits, and they're, what they say there is that the jinn, like, they will present themselves as for example a Yowie or an alien or poltergeist activity or a ghost or anything like that. So I sometimes think it's quite interesting to think that these things might all be connected. And you've probably heard a lot about lights in the forest with Bigfoot, like the Will-o'-the-Wisps.
Yeah.
And all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I was just curious to get your thoughts on that, because I know some people are dead set against it and some people kind of embrace it, you know?
Well, I think, as with anything, I don't think these phenomena, it's a one size fits all. So I'm one of those people that thinks that, why can't more than one type of thing be going on? Mm-hmm. Yeah, why, you know, like Bigfoot, why does it have to be just a hominid? Perhaps people are seeing other aspects of it. And, you know, it's one of those things, if you want to cause an argument in cryptozoology, you just put a hominid Bigfoot researcher and a paranormal Bigfoot researcher together. And then if you really want to kick things off, you just bring somebody in who thinks they're aliens, and that, you know, just lock the door and let them go for it. Yeah,
it shows you how deep the sort of, I suppose, the scope of cryptozoology is, because there's room for people who believe in a solely paranormal Bigfoot, and then there's room for people who believe in, and I'm kind of like that. I believe in the more sort of traditional, I suppose. Oh, it's some type of, maybe it's a group of lads that went tribal and, you know, they started to grow out their hair, and then eventually this is wild men.
Yeah, they're like listening to Pearl Jam.
Yeah, they're like Alice in Chains fans.
Well, you know, Seattle. They could all be sort of remnants of the grunge scene. Why not?
We might have just solved this, you know. We might have solved this.
We need to go looking for some sub pop rarities in the woods and see what's going down there, see if we can track some early Kurt Gidabain and stuff down. But it is interesting that what I would say is what I thought I knew 3 years ago, I know now how little I actually knew. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of Strange Familiars. It's one of the shows I've listened to for a long time, and I'm always interested to listen to different perspectives, because I think I often hear this from people I speak to, that no one is a real expert. They've just know a lot about a specific part of a situation. And I don't think anybody can claim to be an expert, whether it's ufology, paranormal, cryptozoology. They can just know as much as possible. And I think one of the things a lot of people tend to forget sometimes. So
no, you're right. Because like, you can't be an expert for something that you actually haven't dealt with or handled, or like, you know, until you have a Bigfoot like sort of in a cage, then you can be an expert, because you can properly study it and say, right, this is exactly what it is, blah, 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 blah. But like, it's all hypothetical, really. It's all sort of theoretical. We're just thinking and sort of spitballing ideas. Which I think is what makes it also fun as well, though, because you can have, there's a lot of room for fun and having to crack with it as well, because it's so, I think it lends itself so well. I noticed that you actually interviewed a guest recently. His name escapes me, but he's a comedian himself.
Yeah, and, David Race.
Yeah, David Race, that's the one.
Yeah.
And he says himself as well, like, that it's, you know, having comedians talk about Bigfoot is great, like, because there's so much room for humor there. And it's true, like, that's what we do with the podcast. We just kind of shoot the shit and have the laugh about these creatures, because ultimately it doesn't really make any difference to our lives whether they're real or not, but it's a fun trip trying to find out, you know.
I think you're totally right to piggyback on Rob there, is like, you know, the ghost, and it's funny you're talking about the poltergeist activity. I was listening, and you probably heard Jim Harrell and Real Ghost Stories Online and all that as well, but there was one there about a social care worker, and this is like 2000, I didn't, this could be just a couple of years ago, and the social care worker was writing because they saw a kid basically walk towards a wall and then walk up the wall, the sheer, you know, vertical side, really spooky stuff like that, you know. Totally, like, I think all this stuff, what we found is, because a good friend of ours is Gordo, who does those conspiracy guys, the thing is that it's a lot easier to do something about monsters and ghouls, because ultimately the stakes are a lot lower, if you know. It's like, does your government try to do X, Y, and Z? And there's a lot of fear and stuff in that, especially now in the pandemic, and a lot of people kind of leaning one way or the other on that. But whether Bigfoot is real or not is kind of like, I hope he's real, you know. but it's not going to change your outlook on your government and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it's spooky, it's creepy, and it's fun at the same time, you know, unless you live in a haunted house, as you said you did, which maybe it's a bit more intense then.
That'll start you off, right? What age are you, Paul, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 48 now.
So what was your, because you're of a different generation than us then, because I'm 33, Eamon's actually 65.
Sound a day over 50.
what got you into cryptozoology then? Because we have our own sort of origin story about how we got into it. What was your introduction to it? What really tickled your fancy?
It was Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
Arthur C. Clarke is great, isn't he?
And it was, yeah, it was just a show on. I think they used to show it Sunday nights when I was a kid. I think I was eight or nine. But my parents fed my obsession because I loved monsters. I loved all the Universal horror films like Frankenstein and Dracula and the Mummy and the Invisible Man. So I was reading books about horror films when I was five or six that my older cousins weren't allowed to read, because I was always able to conceptualize the fact that these were just stories. Whereas some of my other relatives couldn't grasp that difference.
yeah, for sure.
So I was obsessed, but I do remember one of the first times I ever felt afraid watching something was watching the episode about the Loch Ness Monster. And I think it was to do with things like the Kraken as well.
It's
just that concept of being in the middle of the ocean in a really small boat, not knowing what, having no idea what the hell's going on underneath the surface.
I think it's the same reason Jaws was such a for people our age as well. Again, I'm not quite 65, 36, sorry, but we're getting there. but it's you know, my uncle I think introduced me to Jaws when I was 10, and man, even swimming pools were high anxiety for me for a long. You know, I had this image because I was sort of too young to understand plumbing, like you're a ghost. But you know, I would just imagine this great white shark like breaking through the tiles into the pool, and it was like, well, you're on your own now, kid. But really, really scary stuff. And I do remember as well, I think when it first, I remember watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Halloween, like, you know, 12, 13, something like that. And I remember staying awake all night waiting to hear the chain. I was like, when I hear that chainsaw, I am out this window, I'm running away. I was ready for it. And even though there's a part of your brain that's like, that's a movie, you know, that's not real, I could never get too far ahead of the part of me that was terrified by it.
I used to, you know, watch loads of horror. Like I was saying, my parents were quite supportive in that kind of matter. But it's quite interesting that they would tend to watch something, and if it was deemed acceptable, they would leave it on the mantelpiece for me to watch on Sunday mornings.
And my parents did something like that too, yeah.
And the only film I wasn't allowed to watch at that age, which was like 10, 11, 12, was Halloween. So I ended up creating, I mean, it was crazy really, because I'd seen like The Evil Dead and Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff.
Evil Dead frightened the shit out of me,
And so I ended up building up Halloween for years in my head and kind of not watching it. And then the first time I watched it, I thought it was rubbish. I think that's because I just built, it must be terrifying because my parents won't let me watch it. And now, obviously, it's one of my favorite horror films ever made. I adore it. I think it's a fabulous one. I love all of John Carpenter's stuff, really.
Oh, yeah. The Thing is like... so good, you know. I even have a really soft spot for vampires, even though ostensibly I know it's not good, but I love it. You know what
I mean?
It's
got some good bits in it, though. It has really good scenes.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I think it's done. I think all his films have that real nice, like, they're B movies, but they're sort of just a little bit left to center to give them their own little spark, you know?
And people, it's one of those things because his early work, so. He basically just went bang, bang, bang in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, because he had Halloween, The Fog, Escape from New York, The Thing, Christine. So he was just basically hitting the base every time. And I think he just built such a fantastic repertoire so early that as it moved on, I think it was always going to be hard to keep that level of quality up, because I think you get to sort of They Live and Prince of Darkness, and then that's kind of where I kind of drop off with my appreciation of him.
I can understand that.
But it's just that one of those things, because I own every film he made from Halloween to They Live. I own every single film he did in that period. Apart from the Elvis film, obviously.
you're in the Yorkshire area. Yeah, so do you remember all that? Like, we're going on to real horror now, never mind the fake horror. So you were about for all the Yorkshire Ripper stuff, were you?
Yes, I was, yeah. Obviously, ironically, living in Sheffield is where he was caught.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. So you would have been what age when all that was kicking off then?
When he was caught, I was 9.
Okay, but, right.
But I do remember as a lad, my mum worked. My mum had three jobs when I was a kid growing up.
Yeah.
And she worked behind a bar. And I remember once waking up and getting really frightened that she wasn't home because I'd been hearing the news. Yeah. So I was sat downstairs and she was like, "What are you doing up?" And I was like, "Oh, I was just worried. I thought the Yorkshire Ripper might have got you." I mean, but we were quite fortunate where we were because he basically bounced around us.
Mm,
you know,
never Manchester.
Manchester. I mean, ironically, my brother lives near Roundhay Park in Leeds.
Okay.
And he, I think he had four victims in that area. But yes, he got caught by accident in Sheffield.
That's right. Yeah, I watched that Netflix documentary there that came out was the last year. It was a great documentary, actually. It was really kind of captured, I think, the vibe at the time.
Yeah.
As well, like, because there was like the cultural pushback of the message of women need to stay home on their own, like stay home and don't be out alone. And there was a pushback from women at the time saying, "Fuck that, we're going out to drink pints if we want. Like, we don't give a fucking shit."
Shouldn't the serial killer stay in rather than fuck that shit.
So he's probably actually looking at it now. He's probably the most scary figure to come out of Yorkshire, right? Is there any local cryptids that you have, or because we have a few in Wexford? We have like Tommy the Pigeon, David the Snail, all these people. We've actually got an episode on David the Snail coming out next week. But have you got any from Yorkshire or the area that are sort of local folklore tales or cryptids or anything like that?
Yeah, we've got a couple. A couple of good ones, and hopefully I can tell you a silly one as well.
Nice, nice.
So obviously, probably the most famous one we've got for Yorkshire is obviously the Barghast, which is one of our. Which is the Yorkshire version of the Black Dog.
Oh, yes. Okay. We've done an episode on them. Yeah.
So that's what we call them round here. They're either called, depending which part of Yorkshire you're in, it's either Barghast or Padfoot.
Okay. Padfoot. Right. Nice.
So we have a long tradition of black shuck type creatures in all parts of Yorkshire. Obviously, towards East Yorkshire, as it is now, you've got the famous werewolf, Old Stinker.
All right, nice. That's nice.
who occasionally pops up. There was a bit of a werewolf flap around there about five, six years ago that a couple of people had claimed to have seen a giant upright canid running about.
Why is he called Old Stinker? Is it because he shit his pants or what's the crack?
Well, apparently he lived near an old sewage slurry dip, so he stinks. So that's why they call him Old Stinker. But that story's been around for quite a while, so it's not just one of those modern. Because the other thing you've got to that often I find interesting is that it's always strange how things seem to suddenly appear in different areas when they become very popular. I mean, if you know, unless you really knew much about dog men 20 years ago, you wouldn't never have heard of it outside of what Linda Godfrey did and what was going on in Wisconsin, and now they seem to be everywhere.
That's true. They're like in vogue at the minute.
So that's one of the things. So Barghasts and Padfoots are always good. And like I said, I've got there seems to be a bit of a few strange sightings going out towards East and North Yorkshire. That a friend of mine, Paul Sinclair, who's an investigator, as you said earlier, high strangeness of a variety of topics, is currently filming a documentary interviewing several witnesses who are claiming to have had encounters with upright canids in a wood.
Man, that is really like what I was saying, being in vogue at the moment. There's a huge amount of like you're saying, canine hominids, I suppose. Is that what you call it? Upright canids. And I mean, to me, like, look, I respect to Bigfoot and all. The idea of an upright dog freaks me out more for some reason. You know what I mean? And some of the things I've heard about the way that they kind of stalk people, the way that they kind of keep looking at them. There was someone talking about, I remember it was actually an episode of Strange Familiars. It was a guy talking about that the one of these dog men and about his son talking about the dog. You know, they had a like 8-foot fence or whatever. Mm. And he was like, the dog was just sort of looking over the fence at him and all this sort of stuff. Other scary ones about, and this is more Bigfoot, but Bigfoot who would tap on the window and try to get the kids to come out and play and stuff like that, like Freddy Krueger, Bigfoot type stuff, just really, really unsettling. And some of the stuff you have there where, you know, with dogmen as well, just trying to, because a lot of it is, and what your man would talk about as well, Wes on Sasquatch Chronicles, he talk a lot about, like, you know, we have this sort of very romantic idea of Sasquatch for a lot of people where, you know, one with nature and blah, blah, blah. But he was big into talking about how, like, they're trying to eat your kids and stuff for a long time. And there's some, you know, really scary stuff. And even some of the people I remember on a show who would start, they would kind of break down crying and stuff in the middle of the show, just recounting that sort of that moment where they saw, whether it was a dog man or a Sasquatch or whatever, and just that element of, like, the uncanny, like, I can't believe that this is a real thing, but I'm here confronted with it. But it sounds very traumatizing. And I'm sure Linda Godfrey, as you were saying as well, like Beast of Bray Road and all that sort of stuff, like, there's some people that had a real hard time trying to reconcile that with reality.
Yeah, I think that's, for me, they are the most compelling accounts, regardless of what kind of cryptid or experience it is, when people have a traumatic reaction to it, because then you are dealing with a situation that takes it beyond just somebody telling you a story. Because we can, like we've been saying, it's quite fun to talk about cryptids and creatures and all sorts, but when you hear somebody interviewed in regards to a Bigfoot experience, primarily, because that tends to be the biggest one, where you speak to people who have spent their entire lives in the woods, hunting, fishing, whatever, and then they have an experience and they do not do that again.
Yeah.
They're basically in shock. And I think it's difficult because not only are they in shock and it's changed how they view their place in the world, they're trying to explain the reason that they're shocked is that apparently they've had an encounter which, to all intents and purposes in the eyes of science, doesn't exist.
That's the sort of wildcat stuff is very interesting. We're talking about sort of reliable authors of their story, I suppose. We had one very close to home here in Wexford literally yesterday. You've probably seen it on Instagram.
I did.
So this guy, apparently it's a place called Owlert. It's not far from here at all. But he captured a panther like creature and on camera. And he says, like, the guy himself's he says he does a bit of hunting or whatever, so he knows, like, kind of from a range, the size of an animal. And so it's very compelling. And then the neighbors that live beside him said that it's their pet cat, and they posted they posted pictures of the cat on the Facebook group. He posted it because he posted it to, like, a big cat group or something. And then the neighbors just came out and went, "Ah, fuck off, Larry, will you? That's our cat." And posted pictures of the cat. And he was like, "It's definitely not the cat. I know the difference. It is not the cat." So it's interesting though, but when it's so close to home, like, my first instinct was, right, I'm going to message Eamon. We're going to go hunting for this thing, for the crack. But then there was a part of me that was like, I think, because I suppose I was thinking about it a little bit last night, is like, here in Ireland, and maybe you're the same in England, we sort of entertain a lot of the American cryptids as sort of like far away. So we're like, maybe they're real, maybe they're not, doesn't really matter, whatever. And so I think I was applying the same thing to this big cat, but I was like, hang on. If us two dumbasses end up out in a field somewhere and we're not prepared, we don't have a gun, and we're just looking around with, like, a stick, and we're, like, vlogging ourselves doing this, it's like, it's a recipe for disaster. So I don't want a fucking chance.
That would definitely be the way that we were undone by nature, just mauled to death by a giant cat that we didn't take seriously. Like, that's totally it.
It'd be a good way to go.
You'd certainly hit the headlines. I mean, obviously, ABCs, big black cats, Mr. Alien big cats, whatever.
There's so
many of them here in England. And some of them are really quite compelling, because obviously everybody's heard of the Beast of Bodmin. But then you've got the Beast of Exmoor, which is probably a lesser known one. But the government sent the Marines out looking for that. And that's a matter of fact.
Were they stationed close by or something like that, I think?
Yeah, and they sent them out because there were so many livestock being mutilated, cattle and sheep and goats and stuff, which is also the other thing, because obviously I've got to know a few big cat researchers and investigators here in the UK, and a lot of them will always say big cats won't go after sheep because of the wool. They're not interested. It's too They just can't be asked.
Just so much foreplay, like the ones who want to get straight to the meat, they're not bothered arsing around with that fluff.
They prefer a horse or a cow or something like that, or a pig. But there have been numerous really good ones. I mean, like you guys were on about, you know, going hunting for one. But there's a very famous case here called the Beast of Sydenham, which I think happened 20 years ago. Oh. And that ended up with a guy who was a bodybuilder having to fight one off because it had pounced on him. And it cut him, and it basically was face to face with him. And he reported it and was told that it was a Labrador. And he was like, it wasn't a Labrador. I was wrestling it. I don't know how I got away with it. And so often, like you say there, people will always say, oh, it's just a fat cat. It's a domestic tabby. And there's been a couple of, there was another case from London where somebody claimed they'd seen a lion, and that turned out to be somebody's fat tomcat, which makes you wonder what kind of nature documentaries these people are watching if they think a fat tomcat's like a lion. But as you were on about Yorkshire cryptids, there was a famous case around here a few years ago.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Where, strangely enough, in a little village between Barnsley and Sheffield called Birdwell, people reported to the police that there was a lion on the loose. When they turned up, it was a dog with alopecia. And it had got a mane of fur. People were saying there was a lion on the loose, and it was just a dog that had lost most of its hair. Poor thing.
It's mad, isn't it? And you think as well that like England as well, much like Ireland, everyone has a dog pretty much, and you're how did you not realize the difference between that? Yeah. You know,
but you know the way we can imagine from being from Wexford, like people would just want to sort of have the best story. It's just I saw a lion in town the other day. And someone was like, you think that's bad? You know, I saw the chupacabra. It just keeps going and going.
Maybe that's how cryptids started, you know. Maybe it was just a dick measuring contest with lumberjacks. But that's what some of it actually is. It's like the jackalope and stuff like that. The name escapes me now for what like the terms for all those creatures are, but they're basically invented by lumberjacks. It was a way for lumberjacks to pass the time.
But as well, the jackalope as well, isn't it? There's a virus that rabbits can get, and it makes these big kind of what basically can look like antlers if they're coming out of the right place. I can't even remember what it is off the top of my head. I had notes saved for a jackalope episode, but basically they can look really gnarly, really scary, you know. I just can't remember the name of the virus off the top of my head.
Well, I won't be surprised, because there are examples of people growing horns, because it's just like an over calcification.
We have a lad here called Horny Jim as well in town.
I don't know if that's calcium now, to be honest with you. That's something
else. But those lumberjack stories are quite strange, because there's a few of them, like you say, because there's the hide behind is another one where you'll hear it and you'll turn around and it'll run around the back of you so you can never quite see it. And the hoop snake.
It's a
snake that bites its tail and just rolls.
It's like that film about the tire, isn't it? What was that?
Oh, rubber. DJ Wazzo, wasn't it?
I never actually watched that. It's
actually well worth watching. It's a great movie. It's crazy, but it's great.
I've seen a lot worse. I watched a film the other week, which was absolutely awful. Called Blood Sucking Pharaohs in Pittsburgh.
Sounds great.
And it's one of those, because as we were saying about my teenage years watching, you know, I'd always go to the video shop and just get anything out. So I've seen it all the
same,
and I don't know how I've missed this, but having seen it, I understand, because it was one of them films that clearly somebody went, Jesus, we can't let the public see this. And it doesn't involve any pharaohs. they're not bloodsuckers, so there's no vampires. And basically, it was a film that's written in the style of, they clearly thought it was hilarious, so I can only assume that everybody involved in it was knee deep in cocaine.
Right.
Yes.
And it was a former porn star as the lead antagonist, and basically it's a serial killer who uses a variety of power tools to murder prostitutes.
Okay.
Classic.
And it's one of those where clearly they thought it was hilarious, because whenever she'd turn up to kill somebody, she'd have like a generator to power the power tool.
Somebody gets killed
with a leaf blower,
a chainsaw, a hedge trimmer.
It's just like, oh.
We do a thing with my cousins when I stay down in Tremor, so they'll come over and we'll watch like the worst horror movies we can find, you know? And the last one I got, we got one called Halloween Camp. And the tagline was Trevor versus Jason. No reason. There was no, like, when you watch the movie, there was no reason for that to be said there. Like, there was no Jason. There was no reason. Made no sense.
Was Trevor in it?
I can't even remember. Oh, Trevor was like, yeah, I think Trevor was the ghoulish fella. Jason was just the lad that got killed, but they didn't, like, he didn't come back or anything. Like, made no sense.
Have any of you guys seen that? What's the Halloween film with Chuck Norris basically fighting Michael Myers? Have you guys seen that?
No, but I must see that.
I'm intrigued. Now look, I've mentioned something interesting and none of us have seen it. I think Quentin Tarantino mentioned it on Joe Rogan, is where I heard it. And it's basically like Michael Myers style character. He breaks out of the asylum, I think, and kills everyone.
Now I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And then Chuck Norris is on the case. He's like the policeman chasing him. So I think Chuck Norris kicks the shit out of him. But it's actually supposed to be a pretty decent film for what it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you remember when Busta Rhymes gave, like, they were all shooting Michael Myers and shit. He wasn't going down. Yes. And then Busta Rhymes gave him a cross kick and put him on his back in Halloween 8 or whatever it was.
Was that H2O, was it? I think that's like the worst.
No, that was the one after. There was Halloween Resurrection, was that one. Resurrection, because that's where the students go into the. It's not good.
It's my least favorite of the Halloween films, I think.
Yeah, the last one was a bit strange as well. There was a couple of bits in that that were a bit... I mean, maybe it's because now I'm a podcaster and I just didn't like the fact that the two podcasters in it were a pair of dicks.
Yeah.
Screaming at him. I'm like, what are you doing?
Laugh like...
I think it's Hollywood just either jealous of podcasters now because they're taking the power away.
Yeah, independent media is just... They created found footage films and now it's coming back to haunt them.
It is, though. It's funny, isn't it, how there's this, like, basically this whole independent... And you love to see it. Like, an independent media sort of movement where everyone can exist in their own sort of sphere. And, you know, thrive and network with people. And it's like yourself, Paul, like you've had, I'm sure if maybe 15 years ago, I'm not sure of what you were doing before the podcast, but like if you had said to yourself 15 years ago, oh, you'll have interviewed, I don't know, however many you've interviewed, but I'm guessing like nearly 100 plus now, is it?
Yeah.
You probably would have thought that would have happened.
If you'd have said that 5 years ago.
True.
And it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting how it's probably my main source of entertainment now is podcasts.
Same as. Spend a huge amount of time listening to podcasts. Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm just pottering around the house doing stuff or whatever, or I'm cooking tea, or, you know, I'll just stick a podcast on.
I never listen to the radio ever. I never liked it because I'm a bit of a music snob. I was like listening to what I want to hear.
Yes.
So like I used to hate the radio because especially in Wexford, there's not a great selection of stations. So it's not like, oh, I can put on the hard rock station. Like that wasn't there. So like I'd always find myself like lately, I'm like, people still text into radio shows and ask them to play a song. It's just fucking open up fucking Spotify. Yeah. It's actually quicker, that has to be
Russian bots or something. That's not real, that has to be China. Like that's not real people. No way.
Yeah. I've got a few friends who are DJs and they'll tell you that those people exist. They're always the people that will come in no matter what bar they're in and will either ask for ABBA or Queen. Doesn't matter what you're playing, if you're doing a new wave synth wave set, or you're doing a hard rock night, somebody will come up and say, can you play Dancing Queen? Or have you got Radio Gaga? or something like that. It happens all over the place. And I laugh every time I see one of my mates who's a DJ mentioning what crap he's been asked for this weekend.
Imagine, like, so you just got into podcasting as a sort of a hobby, I suppose. And it's kind of like the same as me and Em, and we jumped in at the start of lockdown, essentially.
Yeah.
And Eamon had done podcasts, and so had I had, maybe not with the same frequency, I had done two different podcasts in the past, but kind of never stuck to them. But we always had a mutual interest in cryptids and paranormal weird stuff. Like, we always used to like frightening each other or whatever, so we said, right, let's pursue the podcast or whatever. What was it that got you into it?
I did it to save my mental health, I have to be brutally honest. I had basically loved this kind of subject for a long time and ended up in a relationship where I was told that everything I was interested in was stupid and boring, and it all went horribly wrong, and it finished after nearly 20 years. And I just thought, right, I've spent 20 years holding all this shit in. How can I just let it all out? Rather than get a restraining order from various authors and things, I thought, well, let's give it a go. So it took me quite a while. Basically, the biggest thing is, like, as we were saying, I had no kind of social footprint in regards to being part of any scene or having a real relationship with people. I mean, obviously, I'd listened to a few podcasts and sort of, you know, I mean, you can't say you build a relationship up with them because you don't really know these people. But, you know, I'd had a few emails and got, basically would talk to them.
Yeah.
So it was just basically that. And then I just thought, well, what's the worst that could happen?
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought, well, let's give it a go. And here we are 137 episodes later.
And I think that's a great message as well for listeners, is that, you know, we have people that listen to us and they're wanting to start a podcast, or they're not quite sure how to get into it or whatever. But I think, like you said, there, it's very important if you're into something that maybe you don't have a lot of friends into the same thing.
Yeah.
So you kind of find yourself maybe internalizing it, you're talking to yourself about it, you don't really have an outlet for it.
Yeah.
It is actually better to put yourself out there and find like-minded individuals. Now, that could be something just as simple as maybe just joining a group on, say, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever.
Yeah.
Or you can go and you can set up a podcast, which I think is a great thing, because, you know, you get to talk to these people and actually interface with them and stuff. And it's just so cool to be out there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, one of my biggest rules is, if you don't ask, you don't get. And if you don't try something, then it's one of those cliches that, oh, well, you'll always regret it for the rest of your life. I mean, it's one of those things that, yeah, I've been doing it now 2.5 years and I'm really pleased with where it is. But I really do think, what if, you know, I'd have done it 5 years earlier, 10 years earlier. You look at people like you mentioned earlier, Jim Harold, who's just been, you know, who is the podfather in the paranormal world. And it's incredible to think that these people were so forward thinking now when you look back, because, I mean, what are there, 750,000 podcasts?
Yeah.
And you have, I mean, that was the other thing as well. I learned so much about, you know, other than the fact that I'd been listening to them for about, because it was my brother that got me into podcasts. Right. So I think the Micah Hanks Show, or the Grailian Report as it was then, Jim Harold and Howard Hughes's The Unexplained were probably the three I started listening to around 2010.
Right.
And kind of followed it on from there with things like Into the Fray and the Ghost Story Guys and Sasquatch Chronicles and Monster X Radio and things like that. So, and obviously you guys.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to see where we've come over that period, and to get to that point where I thought, well, I'm just going to give it a go, but just basically reading as much as I could about it, because it's very different to listening to it and interacting with people who produce a podcast. But when you come down to the nitty gritty, you go, well, what the hell do I do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you find out ways to tackle it and stuff. And ladies and gentlemen, we lost Eamon for a moment there. But he is back and he is on his phone. So if you're wondering why there's a difference in quality, for our listeners, Eamon uses a mix of technologies. He has his laptop is powered by solar power and a guinea pig on a wheel, and the guinea pig's actually died. So
yeah, they just weren't able to handle it. But luckily enough, now I had because I just finished using some toilet roll there earlier today, so I did still have the cardboard roll, and thankfully with a combination of some twine as a conduit, I've been able to fashion a makeshift Skype machine, I believe is the technical term.
Nice. So welcome back, Eamon, because he went quiet there and I was like, hey, where's Eamon gone? I checked my phone and the battery had gone. So yeah, there we are. But I think it, like you're saying, getting out there, mixing with everyone, and just sort of interfacing with people, it really does make it worthwhile and it enhances it. Mm-hmm. And moreover, it's even better when you get to talk to your listeners and you get their stories, and we're starting to hear stories from people. We recently added Collins to the podcast.
Yeah.
So you could just leave a voice. And we're getting some pretty cool voice notes actually from people. We're starting to hear the, we actually had a, we're playing it on this week's Mini Fuzz, but there's a sort of a big cat sighting in England, and it's actually a really compelling one. It almost ends in a car crash.
Oh.
So Eamon hasn't even heard that one yet. Eamon, it's a cracker actually. Yeah, and so you get all these things coming in, and it's crazy because, like, to be honest, when we started, Eamon and I, we knew that, you know, we had our bits about cryptids and things that we were into, and you know, we didn't know that much really.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's not like we were, like you said, there's no one really an expert, you just sort of learn as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And we absolutely weren't experts, and as we're going, we're still learning, and you're finding out so many different things. Like I would say at the start, I didn't even really know that there was so many different types of, like, Bigfoot, say for example, like a Yowie. I never really knew about a Yowie, or I never knew about all the different, like, I knew about the Yeti, I guess, but just different regional variations, I suppose. Completely ignorant to that, you know?
Yeah. Like your Yerans and your Almastis and your Orang Pendex.
Yeah, exactly. All those guys. You've got all the knowledge there, yeah.
Yeah, but like, I remember hearing you recently, you guys were on about going to, wanting to go to the Congo looking for Mekelle and Mbembe.
Oh, yeah. That's the dream.
Which is a strange one, because that's a really, like we were talking about the different sort of gangs in cryptozoology. That's really kind of seen as a bit far out, which, you know, is remarkable when you think that some of the creatures we talk about. But when you start to talk about living dinosaurs, people start to get, their palms get a bit sweaty and they get a bit. And once you delve into it, it's not quite what you think it might be. And that's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, like, Mekelle Mbembe, see, I think personally, Mekelle Mbembe is more plausible than a chupacabra, for example, or at least a more alien looking chupacabra.
Yes.
Or more plausible, even than a dogman. Like, I mean, if you know animals and you know, like, what can on paper and can't exist, well, then I suppose a dinosaur is just as possible as a dogman, if not a little bit more, because dinosaurs actually did live, whereas we don't have any hard evidence of what would be a dogman outside of sort of anecdotal evidence of, you know, sightings of werewolves, because, like, werewolves and dogmen are related, right, Eamon? You're kind of the dogman expert.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose you've got, like, the Beast of Bray Road, the Michigan dogman, just the general sightings that people say they see and stuff. What's interesting is you kind of start getting back to the, again, more Egyptian folklore and stuff with Anubis and all that kind of stuff. And then as well, I think we've probably touched on it in places before, talking about the werewolf, Peter Strauss, was that his name?
That's Strauss? Him, Strauss.
It's just Stump. Yeah, that was it. It's just about, like, to me, some of it I wonder about is the trying to differentiate from our sort of wilderness. Because even when you go back into, let's say, sort of Wild West times, Sasquatch was more dignified than he is now when they would talk.
Gentlemen, they used to wear tuxedos and stuff like that.
Not quite that so much, but he put a bit of pomade in his hair or whatever.
Nice.
But yeah, apparently, because at that point, I think we said it before, it was like you could sort of opt to go wild. So there was an element of civility to it. Whereas now it's I mean, you can't, well, you can, but it's not really an option that's in any way sort of moderate demand, you know, that kind of way. You just have these one in a couple of million people who just disappear into the forest.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you look back at those sort of reports from frontier America from the 19th century, that sort of when the stories start appearing in the press from about 1830, 1840, they're all described as wild men. Mm-hmm. And then obviously as science progresses through the century, they suddenly start to become gorillas.
Yeah.
And it changes about 1870, 1880.
Mm-hmm.
But like you were saying, the theory was that people could just drop off the grid, go live in the woods, and they just become hairy. And loads of them as well, they're all described as having red hair.
Oh, well, Eamon has red hair, so he knows all about these guys.
But
fiery demeanor.
So it's strange how that's basically coming from the sort of press of the time, because obviously if you look at what was going on in Native American cultures in Canada and in America, it's a very different story to what was being portrayed in the papers. So it's like you've got two versions of it, because it always gets on my goat when somebody says, oh, well, Bigfoot didn't appear till 1958. Well, probably at least 1,000 newspaper reports that predate that date, if you really can be asked looking for them.
And you have the native accounts of the Sasquatch and things like that, which were the sort of the wild people. But I don't know, it's weird as well, because I suppose the most famous sighting of Bigfoot, you know, Patterson-Gimlin, kind of ties in with that sentiment, because culturally at the time there was a lot of that, like King Kong, wild monkey man type of stuff. And we sort of covered this on the podcast, that because everyone's always, you know, everyone focuses on the ditties, they focus on the boobs, Paul, you know, they're always going on about the boobs on his costume. But at the time there was apparently it was a very popular circus act to have a woman turn into a gorilla in a sort of a magic show. So we sort of theorized at the time that maybe this costume was one of them, you know, that it had the breasts, and that answers the, because we sort of, you know, we do at the end of every episode like what's called a sort of a sighting or a shiting, where we think where we think it's actually, you know, we believe what we've read or we don't believe what we read.
Yeah.
And Patterson-Gimlin, I think ultimately I don't know where I fell. I'm definitely not on the side of 100% believing it, because there's a lot of dog shit around that story that it's. Yeah. There's so much smoke that I'm kind of looking for the fire, if you get me, where I'm like, I want to, like, believe you or me, I want to believe that, absolutely. I'd really love to have conclusive proof and be like, yep, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so much. And when we were doing the notes for the episode, I just kept finding stuff. And then every time I'd find something compelling, I'd find something against the compelling stuff.
Yep.
And it's I still don't know where I'm settled. I am leaning a little bit towards shiting. where do you sort of sit on that one? What do you think about the Patterson-Gimlin?
I'm probably, I wouldn't say I'm 100% convinced.
Yeah.
But I've often looked, I mean, obviously anybody that's into Bigfoot, because I'm obsessed with Bigfoot. I just love it. For me, I think that what I've often heard is, and obviously because of my love of B movies, I'm aware of how crap monster suits were at the same time.
Yeah. Yep.
So for me, I think one of the biggest supporting pieces of evidence for it was when Animal Planet tried to recreate it about 7 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you've ever seen that, it's just hilariously bad, just how bad it looks. And the thing I've often said is, if you want to prove that it's fake, I want you to redo it
with
everything you could get your hands on in 1967. And if somebody can do that,
yeah,
then fine, I'll take it on the chin
and
say fair enough.
I've seen some lads leaving the pub now 2 o'clock in the morning that look better than some of the recreations that they were trying to do, you know.
The thing I remember as well with Animal Planet is like they have their, that's a budgeted TV show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's like because I mean, you know, Patterson and Gimlin, like
they didn't have much.
No, Patterson didn't have much at all. I mean, there was even sort of report, you know, that the camera hadn't been paid for
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, it was a bit of a
Because I know Logan had a thing like a con man goes in with a stolen camera and looks for him, manages to get Bigfoot footage of Bigfoot. You know, you're more likely to like, he was just saying like, what are the chances of that? Which, you know, it's quite kind of funny. Yeah. But I do agree with you, Paul. Having watched some of the comparison videos, and certainly that Animal Planet one as well, I think it's very hard to conclusively say one way or the other, you know, trying to go, yeah, this is definitely fake or definitely real.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that, as with any kind of cryptid story, there are always these people that come out of the woodwork and say, oh, well, I was in the suit. Well, where's the suit then? If you've got that suit, you can write your own check. You'd be a millionaire overnight.
That guy, the guy that said that he had the suit or he was
in
the
Hieronymus.
That's him, Bob Hieronymus. He was kind of a character himself that, again, I'm like, I don't know if I believe this dude either, do you know?
Well, there's so many characters throughout the world of cryptozoology, especially when it comes to Bigfoot. You look at somebody like Paul Freeman, if you're aware of him, who may have started off with the best intentions, but he was one of those people that would always remarkably find stuff. He was just too good. And obviously these days a very well known is basically a cryptozoological hand grenade you could throw in is if you mention Todd Standing to anybody. Is another one who also seems to be weirdly successful. And it's one of those things because for the majority of people that have these experiences, it's a one off. It never happens again.
Yep.
And therefore I'm always dubious about anybody that has a repeat sighting. Two, fair enough. But when you're talking, I've become friends with them and we share pine cones and woods, you know, and they've introduced me to their family and things. You kind of think, what are we dealing with here? And if you delve into the world of Bigfoot, there are people out there that are claiming to be communicating with families of Bigfoot. Yep. And they are professing the end of the world and they are these forest people that want us all to live together. It's a crazy world when you, like I say, you've got to be careful what you ask for when you dive into it.
I think the big thing for me was Todd Standing, because I was watching that documentary on, I think it was out on Netflix.
Yes.
It's really interesting. And I was, because like you, I was bought in. I was like, yes, they're taking apples. It's all happening. Finally, it's real. And then that CGI blink. I've had women break that. And I didn't sink so low. I was like, are you? Oh, because I was committed, you know, up until that point, I was really buying into it. When I saw the CGI Sasquatch blink, my poor little heart.
I think as well, like if you're finding like multiple things from like a Bigfoot or whatever, like where was all the rest of these findings throughout history? Like if you're finding them that easy, how come no one else has found them? Do you know what I mean? Like nothing that you're doing is special to make you find them, especially when there's so many. Like, I mean, the average, say, hunter or woodsman, they're another way around better than someone that just wakes up and goes, I'm going to be a Sasquatch hunter, you know?
Yeah.
And those guys, those are the ones to talk to, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And if those guys have tails, then you're like, right, that's interesting. It's like this big cat sighting here in Wexford. This guy hunts. He knows the size of animals. He's familiar with the area. Yeah. So you're like, okay, I believe him a little bit more, actually, because like if me and Eamon, we've kind of discussed this before, is like if we did go on a Michele Membe tour and we did find Michele Membe, no one's going to believe it's real. You know?
Like comedy monster podcast discover evidence of Michele Membe, you know, new age evangelists are delighted. Just so ridiculous. Or new earth even evangelists.
I mean, like you were saying though, like you were thinking that there's probably more chance of Michele and Mbembe existing. But we've got Komodo dragons and we've got crocodiles.
Yeah.
And crocodiles were around the time of dinosaurs as well, you know?
Yeah. And Komodos are enormous are horrifically vicious. So who's not to say that there could be something? I'm not saying there are Brontosaurus or Diplodocus hanging around there, but stranger things have happened. And, you know, there are weird stories all over. Like, you've got the another one in Africa, which is the Belgian air pilot who was flying across and he saw the snake that was 50 foot long.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh, what's he called now? He was somebody that was really well respected. He was a member of the Belgian Air Force, and he ended up becoming sort of a senior position in NATO, I think he did.
Okay.
And he was flying above the Congo in a helicopter and saw a giant snake on the ground, and it reared up to try and bite the helicopter. And he took a picture of it. I've forgotten his name.
Yeah.
Aitana Boa.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. Obviously, that's a terrifying creature that lived in South America. But this was kind of like a normal boa constrictor. But he did take a picture of it. It's one of the most, once again, back to Arthur C. Clarke. Remy Van Lender, something like that.
Oh, I think that's the same guy. Yeah, I think we've talked about him on the podcast before, but I don't think we talked about that sighting that he had seen. I think he's seen a lot of stuff in the Congo. I think that guy, I think that Van Linden name really rings a bell. So it could indeed be him. But before we go, Paul, we've had an amazing chatter. I'm going to ask you a question.
Yes.
who'd win in a fight, Bigfoot or Dogman?
Bigfoot.
You reckon? Yeah. Why?
Well, a chimp can rip a human's arms off, so I'm quite sure Bigfoot can deal with a dog man.
True. I suppose, yeah, when you scale it up, it is like a human versus a dog, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, like, Bigfoot is a bigger human, dog man's a bigger dog, kind of a hominid as well, but I reckon, yeah, Bigfoot, yeah. But then you never know what kind of Bigfoot. Is it the space Bigfoot? You know, Dogman, is he the guy that, you know, was in Seattle listening to grunge music, or is he, you know, has he been taking heroin, or is he sort of hungry, or what kind of Dogman are we dealing with?
Well, as you were saying earlier, I mean, I'm in the more Bigfoots are aggressive camp than I am friendly forest people. So my money's always on a Bigfoot.
Yeah, I think so. Have you got anything you'd like to plug on social, Paul, before we go?
Well, you can always, if you want to catch my show, you can find me just searching for Mysteries and Monsters across all podcast apps and social media. You can find me under Mysteries and Monsters wherever you look.
Yeah, and also if you're from Paul's feed, if you're listening to this on Paul's feed, you can find us at Masterfuzz Podcast everywhere, guys. So, yeah, that's about it. I've been Rob.
I've been Eamon.
That's said bye, Paul.
Yeah, and thank you very much for having me. It's been great fun, lads.
Thanks so much for coming on, Paul. It was I really enjoyed this conversation, even though I dropped out of it several times. That was reflection on yourself. That was my bad technology. But no, so much. Yeah, I really enjoyed this.
Okay, I'll see you guys.
Thanks.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.